Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a variety of guests with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com. Hi, friends. Thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This is another cross post with Faith Transitions. So after Rob Vox and Nancy Ross did an episode with Brittany, they also decided to do an episode with me. So in this episode, you're hearing what they recorded as far as an interview with me. And afterwards, Brittany and I got talking that these episodes of Brittany's story and my story were really heavily focused on talking about our transition out of our faith growing up in Mormonism. And we wanted to do an episode together to talk more about our transition into Community of Christ. So look forward to that. And that's coming up. But I hope you enjoy. Check out other episodes over at faithtransitions.com. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back, everybody, to Faith Transitions. We're excited today to be joined by Josh Mangelson, who is joining us today after we had some great discussion with his partner and spouse, Brittany, a few weeks ago. And after we had had our discussions with her, I got into communication with Josh and asked him if he'd like to join us, and he's agreed. So we're excited to hear that side of the story. Welcome, Josh.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob and Nancy. I'm glad to be here.
And you're very welcome. And of course, we'd like to, as always, introduce you to Nancy and welcome her back to Faith Transitions as well.
Always good to be here.
Great. So we like to just kind of get right to it, start in a sort of an autobiographical sense, and let you start by telling us how your faith journey began as early as you can remember, how faith was a part of your home or wasn't, if it wasn't, and how that shaped your early development.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up here in Utah my whole life. I grew up in Kearns for the first 11 years of my life, and then my parents moved out to Erta, which is a small farming community out by Tooele, so I went to Tooele High School. Growing up in Kearns, for me, I grew up LDS, which is the predominant religion in Utah, and my dad... For people that grew up LDS, they'll understand this term. My dad was a McConkie Mormon.
Right.
So he kind of lived by the book of Mormon doctrine written by McConkie. And he is just more of a literalist believer. I grew up not really ever paying attention to it too much as a kid as far as like getting seriously involved with it other than... That was just part of my worldview.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And on your father's side, in terms of his parenting style, his relationship to the Mormon tradition was this Bruce R. McConkie model. And we had Thomas McConkie a couple weeks ago who also mentioned that there's kind of a very rigid structure to that view of faith. Was that consistent for how your mother treated the Mormon faith during your youth?
Not as much. My dad wasn't like... by the book, like super rigid per se, just more along the lines of his belief. So he would be the one that would try to, model, how would you say it? He would try to be that model of the head of the home. So he'd be the one that would try to lead the family in family prayer every night. and scripture reading. So I remember growing up and we had all those older copies of the Book of Mormon, you know, with the blue cover. And then there's one that had like the gold cover on it and stuff like that. So that's memories that I have growing up is him reading that. And I don't think I got very much out of it when I was actually a kid. But yeah, so he made sure that we read the scriptures all the time. And I remember being afraid for the end of the world. My dad had a very millennialist outlook on life, that the world was going to come to an end. And I was just like, well, we could just drive back to Missouri. That wouldn't be that big of a deal. And he's like, well, and he's like, well, we...
I was just going to say, you may have to explain why Missouri would be the end of the world or what that has to do with that for some of our listeners.
So yeah, in Mormon doctrine, it goes way back to the foundation of Missouri being Adam on Diamond, where Adam would reign again for a short stint in the millennium. And Missouri is east of Eden, essentially, right? So that's where Adam would come back. And everybody, as a gathering point, would have to go back to Missouri at some point. And I remember it just scaring me because we couldn't drive there. We'd have to walk. I'm like, why do we have to walk? Well, all the roads will be destroyed in an earthquake. And I'm like,
right.
Yeah. So it just caused more fear in me than actual adoration, I guess.
Can I ask you too, that as your parents are, or your dad is reading the scriptures to you or the Book of Mormon to you when you're a kid, you know, I had a similar experience, but we read from like the children's version. So that was more child friendly. I'm just wondering what you understood from your dad reading the Book of Mormon to you when you were a kid. Like, can you tell us a little bit about what you got out of that experience?
You know, I don't think I ever understood the actual structure or story of the Book of Mormon until I read it on my own, preparing for a mission. So I, as far as like growing up in primary is children's classes. It's like children's Sunday school in the LDS church. But in primary, I just remember certain stories like King Benjamin and how they had to have the tents in a certain direction, stuff like that. So I didn't actually get the gist of why it was important.
Right. So what was your, I mean, just sort of social relationship too as a youth growing up? Positive, negative? I mean, how would you reflect, as you think about it, what are the kinds of things you think, maybe primary peer relationships?
Overall negative, because when I was in Kearns, I don't know if I would consider myself an empath, but I would just get overly emotional as a really little kid. And other kids would feed off of that energy and just like taunt me. And so like around me in my neighborhood in Kearns, there wasn't anybody that was my actual age. I'd have to go a couple streets over if I wanted to be with people that were Weeblos or in scouting, you know, or or whatever. So by the time I moved to Erda, I was 11 years old. And at that point, it was 93, 94. And Erda hadn't grown very much. So everybody that was there, as far as like all the boys there, had grown up in Erda. They were multi-generational and they weren't too open to newcomers. So that was pretty rough on me for a few years for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So maybe walk us through kind of how is, you know, your faith experience in Utah. So I certainly relate. I grew up in the Utah region along the Wasatch Front. The Mormon experience often becomes all pervasive. In fact, you know, you go to junior high, you start doing seminary. As you transition into high school, from your middle school years, you continue to do seminary and you hang out on the weekends with friends at school who are friends in your ward. What was your experience with any of that, schooling and your faith overlapping at all?
Well, yeah, it just permeates everything. So like when I went to seminary, I remember all the other students in high school going there. I'm like, you're a Mormon? You're a Mormon? Wow, everybody's Mormon. I would have never picked them out as Mormon just in junior high by the way they behaved, I guess. But it's like, okay, you're going to seminary too. And then I just realized everybody was pretty much LDS, give or take a handful of people, you know. So,
right.
Yeah, scouting was rough. It got better when I was about 15, 16, it wasn't as bad. When I got older, because other people started moving in and ended up finding a group of friends by then, but...
Right. And unlike even other areas in the United States, the Boy Scout program is heavily tied with the Mormon Church. And I've had, you know, I've lived outside of Utah a number of times, and you can find Boy Scout troops that aren't associated with ecclesiastical or religious congregations. But in Utah, it's almost synonymous that if you go to church as a young male, you're also involved in Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scout troop or unit is run through the ward. So is that kind of what you're talking about?
Exactly. Okay. So every single leader was called by a ward bishop in the LDS church. And then out of all the boys, they were either active LDS or inactive LDS. I don't think we incorporated any other faiths at all growing up in Urda. So
what made it particularly challenging? Was it, I mean, you said you called on scouts in particular as being rough. Do you remember, do you have stories or something in particular you can convey to talk about that?
Yeah, they just singled me out because I hadn't grown up there. So like when I was 12 years old, 13, somewhere in that, they would choose me to be the person that they would peck on, I guess. And my dad was always into it, so there was no option to get out of it because my dad was always a leader. And I just remember my dad being kind of frustrated with it too, but nothing he could do about it. But then it's not like I had an option not to go because he forced me to go. So,
right.
Yeah.
Boundaries. Go ahead. I'm just going to say one thing, that the boundaries become even blurrier because most of your PAC meetings and all that happen inside the Mormon chapels. So, yeah, you go to Sunday service and worship in the same building that you're having your scout meetings. So,
right.
Go ahead, Nancy.
No, I was just going to say, so your dad wouldn't like interfere or intervene on your behalf when you were maybe being picked on or might I even say bullied by other kids?
Not articulately. Like I knew it frustrated him because I would vent to him and then he would want to go to parents. But by the time he'd go talk to parents, I don't know. It just never came up, I guess.
Hmm. Right.
And how does that frustration, does it transition onto your Sunday school, your priest quorum, your teacher's quorum experience?
Yeah, to an extent. I don't remember my Sundays as much as never being super into it, although I was always the one that was asked to be the leader of each quorum. So when I was in deacons, I was the deacon president. When I was in teachers, I was the teacher's president. And then priest, you can't be the president, but...
Right.
So yeah, I was there. I was the one that would, teachers said this about me. I don't remember what kind of responses I'd give, but they said I was the one that actually had the responses to their lessons and stuff. So, So I guess I knew what to say.
So can I ask you, so you're having this difficult experience at Scouts. It's kind of spilling over into church, but at church, you're kind of put in this, maybe to compensate, maybe not, to kind of put in this position of leadership as you're a kid kind of growing up as a teenager. Can I ask you, what did you feel like you were believing at this particular point? Like how was your belief? What was your belief and how was it developing?
So my belief, yeah, I don't think I really grew into a belief until I decided to go on a mission. Everything had been just what I would consider borrowed light. That's how I would have phrased it at the time. I just borrowed everything from my parents. So, like, scripture study was my dad's thing. Family prayer was my dad's thing. I'd never said prayers on my own until I was older and I approached God, and I guess a dark time. I wouldn't have known how to define it back then, but I would see it as undiagnosed depression at the time. Mm-hmm. So that I made the transition to start working towards going on a mission. So yeah, I had my group of friends. Church was the thing that we did on Sunday. We were really into punk rock and riding motorcycles, and that was just my youth growing up. And I was always like 1 year older than a lot of my friends around me. So I graduated high school before them, and then I kind of had a falling out because they were still in high school and I wasn't. I was working a job, they weren't, and I don't know why, I just didn't have any plans to go to college, didn't have any plans to go on a mission, so I was just working two jobs and riding motorcycles, and by the time I was 20, that's when I turned around and decided to go on a mission, so started working towards that.
Can I ask you why? Okay, can you tell us a little bit more about this first prayer where you're feeling depressed and then you maybe speak your first prayer?
Yeah, so I was 20 years old. I was working two jobs. I was working at a feed supply store up in Tooele, and then I'd drive over to West Valley and work at UPS as a sorter on their sorting line at night. So I was working most of my day. I was staying pretty busy. And I was just not going anywhere. And I knew my life wasn't going anywhere. I don't know. So yeah, I was just, it started to really bug me. Like most of the time I'd get along just fine, but it started to really bother me that I wasn't going anywhere. And so I decided to say a prayer one night, and I just was enveloped with this unconditional love that I had never felt before in my life. And by the time when I went into that prayer, I had no plan to go on a mission. But by the time I finished the prayer, in my religious training, that's what I wanted to do. I think I mixed the two worlds together because that's what I knew was expected of me. But when I felt God's unconditional love, that was my most faithful response, was I need to start working on to go on an LDS mission, which would take me another 6 months to prepare. So,
right.
And how did that feel? That sounds like a pretty transformative experience.
Yeah, it felt wonderful. And it's taken me years to realize that I didn't have to do anything to receive God's unmerited love. God already loved me perfectly, fully, unconditionally. And that's what I was feeling that day. And it took me years after that to realize I didn't have to sit there and, yeah, I think we should make responsible choices, and I think we should be responsible to our communities and try to become the best person we should be, but realize that nothing we say or do can separate us from the love of God, and it doesn't matter where we're at in life. God loves us unconditionally, and life is just kind of a condition, you know?
Yeah. In that moment, did you feel like maybe you were feeling part of God's unconditional love, but are you kind of trying to say that maybe you felt like there were conditions, or that like going on a mission was one of those conditions?
That was just my faithful response at the time.
Okay.
By the time I ended the prayer, I'm like, you know, God, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to go on a mission. Schooling was never important to... My dad got an associate's degree in chemistry, and my mom didn't get a degree in anything. So schooling was just never something I was geared towards. And so by the time I started planning to go on a mission, it wasn't till the day after I turned 21 that I actually went to the MTC. So I went a bit later. Yeah.
Right. So maybe walk us up to through the 6 months, as that transformative moment occurs. You say it takes roughly 6 months to go. Maybe walk us through the 6 months and then, you know, talk about the experience you had on your mission.
Yeah. So 6 months, that was 2003. I didn't go until August of 2003. And by that point, the expectation within Mormonism was that missionaries would raise the bar, and I took that seriously. So I started reading everything I could at that point. I had read the Book of Mormon cover to cover 4 times before I went to the MTC.
Yeah.
Wow.
I read everything I could get my hands on. So I read the New Testament twice, the Doctrine and Covenants twice, Jesus the Christ. I can't remember all the books I read before I actually went to the MTC, and I was like, okay, I'm going to raise the bar. And by the time I went to the MTC, I realized not everybody else had raised the bar, so to speak. Hmm. That other kid still hadn't even read the Book of Mormon in the MTC.
And how did that fear, like that period of furious learning and preparation and reading. How did that feel for you? Like, how did you feel your faith growing and developing?
It indoctrinated me more than anything. So I had a very magical worldview, and that magical worldview over the next few years of my mission and after would slowly be chipped away. So I had the worldview when I got my call to Mexico, Tampico, that the gift of tongues would be a real thing. And I don't know if you know Brooke Hills. He's the one that gives up and gives the statistical reports every general conference or every other general conference. He was my stake president out in Grantsville. And he was the one that blessed me to go on my mission. And the blessing he gave was that I would learn Spanish so well that people would think I had known it since I was born. That did not come true. So,
right.
Despite me trying really hard, that did not come true. So the mission experience was pretty tough for the first year, actually really tough. Even though I had been book trained, so to speak, I wasn't actually like people trained. So I still had a really rough time getting used to having a companion every day, all day, going and teaching people in a language that I didn't know. Yeah, that first year was a culture shock for sure. And I felt really alone. My first companion knew how to speak English. He learned it from watching American TV and from his companions, which was awesome. He actually had a pretty good skill of speaking English. But the rest of my companions, except for like maybe one towards the end, didn't know how to speak English at all.
Right, and so they'd be just speaking Spanish, I would imagine.
Right. So they spoke Spanish to me. Everybody we came in contact with on the street obviously only spoke Spanish. And so, yeah, I felt pretty alone, isolated. Could only contact my family, of course, once a week per email.
Right.
And I just remember asking God, like, I'm here trying to help your work with the one true church. If this is your true church, why aren't you helping me? Why am I not learning this language? And I just remember that was the first time that I'd got zero response to my prayer. I felt like I was praying to the ceiling, and I felt really alone in my first area on my mission. And I was like, what did I get myself into? I knew I couldn't go home. I knew the ostracization that would come coming home early. So I did not come home early. I just was wondering, what did I get myself into?
Right.
Yeah. It got better 6 months to a year in. So
what happened? What changed?
By the point I had been 6 months in, I realized people that were coming from the MTC knew Spanish better than me. Like people that I was teaching even made that comment. It's like, how long has he been here? He's been here longer than you, right? I'm like, no. And that was just a point of embarrassment. So I just decided at that point, I'm going to learn Spanish myself. If God's not going to teach me how, I'm going to do it. And so, yeah, by the time I had a year in, I started learning Spanish a lot better. And by that point, I don't know if it ever got wonderful, my mission per se, but it just got easier because, like, I was culturally acclimated at that point, knew the language pretty well. And I just took the approach that maybe if I was bold, so to speak, I could win God's favor.
So can I ask just a question then? Had you made a big effort to study Spanish, or had you just felt like it was just going to come to you because that's what you had been blessed with?
Right. I thought it was going to come to me, gift of tongues. Yeah.
And so you were, for this first year, you were frustrated that it wasn't happening in the way that you felt or had been led to believe that it was going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. I had a very magical worldview. I mean, going back to my dad, like, he was the type of one that believed that the ice would crack open up and maybe I shouldn't comment about that, but that, you know, the 10 tribes coming out of the ice. So I had a very literal, magical belief about almost everything. And so, yeah, I believed that if the gift of tongues meant that Peter could stand up and speak in an unknown tongue to him and convert thousands of people. And people say, isn't this a Galilean? Like, how is he speaking in our tongue? I believed that could happen for me too. And it did. I realized I had to learn it. Yeah. So 6 months in, I realized I had to really put in my own effort to learn it.
And so as if you have this very magical worldview, what's happening to that worldview once you realize you've actually got to put in the effort and learn the language?
It slowly becomes more nuanced over time, realizing that I have to put in my own effort. But not only that, I thought I had forgotten that first prayer and misinterpreted the whole prayer that got me there in the first place, that I had to win God's favor, that somehow I didn't please God, and that I had to work really hard. I had to bear really strong testimony to the people around me and be not overbearing, but be bold to the people around me in order to win God's favor.
So it sounds like you internalized the inability to speak as a fault of your own.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, you round out your mission much more positive. How does that come to an end, and how did you transition from there to the next phase?
So it came to an end pretty well. I just learned that roles weren't the most important thing. Getting along with my companion mattered a whole lot more. And from my day-to-day success, that if I had to bend on a few things just to keep my companion happy, that was more important. So by the time I ended my mission, it was pretty well. I had been a district leader. That's about as much responsibility. Senior companion and district leader. That's the most responsibility I was ever given as a missionary. And so I came home. I was able to get immediately the job, one of the jobs that I had before I left back, and that was up at the feed store up in Twilla. And so I worked there until I could go to school that spring semester. And I was just trying to plan on which school to go to. I had my mind on BYU. I knew I could never get into BYU with my high school grades. So I thought BYU Idaho. But then just talking to some people in my ward, I had a friend down at SUU down in Cedar City. And he wanted me to go there, but just as far as like filling things out, I decided to go it alone, and I decided to go to Utah State University up in Logan. So I went up there.
So what made you want to go to university, having not really had that desire before your mission?
It's just part of the culture again. Like, I knew it was part of my priesthood responsibility to get as much education as possible, because I would be the sole breadwinner of a family someday. And I knew if I didn't have an education, that making money wouldn't come as easily. So I knew education was important, just from the other people, my mission president especially, that was definitely an expectation. A priesthood expectation was to go get an education. So it was, at the time that I chose to go to school. And plus, obviously, when you go to school, that's where you're going to meet girls, right?
Right.
Like, I had gone to the Twilla Singles Ward, and I knew the girls were sparse out there. So,
right.
So I knew I had to go to a real university to find girls to date. So,
right. The economist in me says market share, right? You got to increase.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to increase your pool if you want to find the right one, right? I should mention, I'll throw this in just to backtrack a bit. I was extremely introverted, so I never dated in high school. I remember the one dance I went to was girl's choice. I went because some girl asked me. I was never brave enough to actually ask a girl. I just feared rejection too much. And another choice of going on a mission was based on girls again.
Right.
I knew I couldn't get a wife that I wanted if I wasn't a returned missionary. So that was also played a factor into it too. So, by the time I went to Utah State, I decided to live in the dorms that first semester, which was kind of fun. That's probably my most memorable, even though it was another hard transition, was living up in Davis Hall in Utah, going to Utah State. the majority of my roommates were all 18 years old. I was 23 at that point.
Right.
I had
the old man on the block.
Right. I had one roommate that was 26, but he locked himself in his room and played on his computer all the time. So,
right.
So he wasn't much of a friend. So yeah, I hung out with these 18 year olds that were on the track team in Davis Hall. So that was most of my experience. I remember being brave enough to ask a few girls on dates that semester. I went to a few basketball games and stuff. So I didn't that first semester have a degree chosen. I was just taking general ed, and I tested out of 16 credit hours for Spanish, which was really boosted my GPA.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what's church like? What's your religious experience like as you come home and decompress from the mission?
Yeah, I would say it was fine. I never got anything that I felt like really plugged me in, as far as being definitely going to singles wards that made me feel like I was needed or anything, just because everybody else was there. So, yeah, just going to singles wards, obviously given the call to be a home teacher. I can't remember. Yeah, no, I was never given a call until I lived in Cambridge Court. I was the secretary of the elders' quorum there. But yeah, so church was just church. Like, it was, I tried to do everything I could as far as church-wise to be there. You know, I went to ward prayer all the time. I realized other people on the ward kind of fell off through the semester, but I kept at it, so...
You'll have to describe what ward prayer is, because I have no experience with ward prayer.
So it's just one extra activity on top of everything else, just to help young single adults get a chance to talk to each other. So ward prayer on Sunday night, after you'd gone to church for a 3-hour block, you would go back to church that night. And
this is hours later, right? So you do your 3 hours early in the day, and then you have a whole day, and then you come back at night.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So you'd go back at night at 6 or 7 o'clock at night, and then you would just have a few devotional type things, and somebody would say a prayer, and everybody would kind of mingle, I guess. And then some of the wards, what they would do is they would give out chips. Like, there's free ice cream chips to go down to get Aggie ice cream.
I was picturing poker chips, right? But not.
Yeah. No.
No. Okay.
No. No gambling.
No, okay. So free tokens to go get ice cream.
Right, free tokens to go get ice cream, and that was just kind of to try to line people up on
good,
these
wholesome,
little mini dates, you
good
know.
Good wholesome activities, right? Right.
Right.
Yeah.
My mind goes to poker chips, forgive me.
So you're kind of, but your ward is trying to like bribe you to go on dates then.
Right, exactly. Yeah. They're trying to give us every opportunity we can to meet each other, I guess.
I want to know how many scrapbooks have these little chips as their first page, right? Taped to the page. This is the moment where we met each other. Anyway, so...
I don't know. Yeah, I think it's more organic than that.
Yeah,
I think
right.
People kind of pair off on their own
right.
Without any help, you know?
So keep going. Sorry to derail you there. How long does this go on? What is this status quo for? How long?
So, no, yeah, the next year I chose to go to Cambridge Court, which was really isolated. Of all the wards I could have chose to go to, I chose one of the two wards that had more men than women. Because I guess it was at the bottom of a hill and girls didn't want to walk up an extra hill. I don't know the reason why there's fewer women down there. So I just made the decision that if I was going to meet girls, it'd have to be outside of my ward. By that point, I had chosen to go into English, professional and technical writing. So that was the degree I was working towards. And so I really got into country swing dancing. And I would do that every week, too.
And this is with a club, I would assume, on campus?
Yeah, so I took a class. And then also there was at the Fun Park, they would have dancing there. I know it was a big thing in Salt Lake, too. I don't know how much of a thing it is anymore these days. Because I know, like, before me, like 5 to 10 years before me, the actual just regular swing was a big thing. But then people kind of fell out of that. So Yeah, so I'd ask out girls going to country swing. And then the next year after Cambridge Court is when I moved into Pineview, and that's when I met Brittany. But Brittany, if you've met Brittany, she looks really young. And she'll probably hate me for saying this, but I never took her seriously because I thought if I take her seriously, people think I'm robbing the cradle, so to speak, just because she looks so much younger than me. And she is 5.5 years younger than me, but she also looks young, just her facial features, you know. And so she was way interested in me, but I never really took her seriously until that. After that whole school year passed, and by the end of the summer, I had decided to start dating her. So, yeah, so I decided to go try to sell security systems. Somebody thought, talked me into that, saying I could make big money. I didn't.
was this a part-time job or career after graduation?
I didn't graduate by that point. That was just a summer.
Yeah, okay. So, okay.
I didn't graduate until after I had married Brittany, so...
So you go on this summer job and don't find the success you want?
I don't find the success I want. I'm too introverted, but no one wants to buy security systems anyway. So you have to really twist people's arms and lie to them to make it happen, which I was not ethically into at all. Like my manager said, if they don't ask it, just don't tell them. I'm like, how can you do that? Like, not tell them that they're getting themselves into a 5-year contract.
Right.
That they can't break. But that was their ethics. Is like, as long as you don't tell them, it's not lying. And I'm like, yeah, it is.
Right.
So I always had a high ethic of, you, and yeah, I just didn't sell as many. And I was talking to Brittany on the phone and stuff and decided to come back home. I was in Chicago at the time, so I came home and decided to start dating seriously Brittany. And yeah, we got married in the end of 2008. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And in terms of faith, your belief, everything is just kind of on track with kind of your experience around you, the Mormon corridor. You know, you come off a mission, you start seriously dating, looking for a spouse, and then go to the temple and that's it, right? You kind of are set for where your trajectory is headed. Is that true of you at this point still?
I'd say so, yeah, more or less. I don't think people are in the position when they're looking for a wife or a spouse in general to really faith deconstruct, because that
right.
There's different types of truth. There's factual truth and practical truth, and killing your dating pool is not a practical truth, you know?
Right.
Like, it's not pragmatic at all. So people, I don't think when they're, like my brother, my youngest brother that's going to Utah State now, he would never deconstruct his faith because he's not married. It doesn't right. make sense to him to do something like that. But I had things that were on my shelf.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask. Was the shelf right. getting heavy anyway?
Not super heavy, just less magical than I had always hoped it would be. And Freemasonry. I knew there's Freemasonry in the temple, and I didn't know what to extent because I didn't look into it super closely right, until I accidentally.
I'm just going to say that's really interesting, and I don't know that we've had any of our guests previous to now express it in that way, but I can relate to that, that there's so much writing on companionship in the culture of Mormonism that if you were to deconstruct it prior to successful, you know, marriage and et cetera, that's dangerous. That's a dangerous proposition. So I appreciate that articulation.
Yeah, no problem.
So yeah, your shelf's getting heavy.
I don't know if I would say it was overly heavy. It okay. was just, okay. yeah, through 2007 to 2009, after I had gotten married. After I was married, I accidentally picked up Duncan's Ritual. I don't know if anybody knows that book, but that's a monitor for Freemasonry. I don't know why, out of the thousands of books that I could have grabbed, I grabbed that one when I was at Barnes & Noble. But I picked that up and I started leafing through the pages and seeing all of their signs laid out, like with these 1800s illustrations that they have inside of it. I'm like, that's the LDS temple. That's the LDS temple. They're making all the signs of the LDS temple, even the handshakes. And so I started studying Masonry, and I didn't like any of the responses that I was getting from faithful LDS people, because the few books that had been out to that point only tried to distance the relationship. Like, well, the temple is all these other things too, and it's not dependent on masonry to be what it is. And I'm like, yeah, it is. Like, I knew in my head that there was too much copy over to distance it like that. So I was like really studying it, like to the point that it was an obsession, I would say, trying to make sense of it. Because like the early Freemason lore of the 1800s was that Freemasonry had started all the way back to Adam, and that there had been Masons all the way through the generations of time, to the point of even building King Solomon's temple. We now know that's not true. Masons were started in medieval,
right?
Medieval times, Scotland, perhaps. But yeah, I was trying to faithfully. It was heavy on my shelf, but I was trying to lead faithfully, trying to understand it from leading with faith. How did Joseph Smith know something that I'm not seeing here? And how does this actually link back to a long time ago? And yeah, that was 2009, all the way up through 2012. There hadn't been too many other things on my shelf at that point.
And you hadn't, I mean, had you or hadn't you talked to folks about this masonry idea? Brittany, maybe in particular, or?
Oh, Brittany. Yeah, Brittany knew, okay, for sure. And so by the time we had our twins, things were just rough. I mean, once we got married, they put us in primary. I don't know why they think it's a good idea. Hey, if you're active LDS, don't put a newly married couple into primary. Maybe some couples love it, you know, but
yeah, I can relate. On Sundays, I was like, why am I in here now again? I just got done with my kids. Yeah, yeah.
Nursery or primary, put somebody that's like really solid and on track into something like that. Yeah, I just remember not being very uplifted every Sunday. So, yeah. So just going along and then just asking. I don't know. It's hard when everything happens so fast to even put it in like a timeline, because it's even hard for myself to figure out. But through 2012, we had moved down to Midvale by that point, and then moved into our current house in Saratoga Springs. Masonry had always been a part of my mind. And Brittany, when we went back up to Logan just to visit Logan, we went to their pumpkin walk that they have every Halloween. And Brittany point blank asked me, do you believe in the temple? And for the first time verbally, I said, I don't know how it could be true. And that took her back big time. Yeah, that did not go over well at all with Brittany.
So that's just like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So what happens? So you kind of have this difficult conversation. What happens afterwards?
We kind of had like a fight out in public. So we just got back in the car with our girls. And I think Brittany, what she would say now is she freaked out so much because the temple had been a hard experience for her too. And so when she realized that I didn't literally believe in it, she was leaning on my belief to get her through. And when she realized I didn't believe it, it didn't go over well. And when I said I didn't believe it, I didn't even know what level that was. I just knew Joseph Smith borrowed from Freemasonry, and it wasn't something that was that I could connect to any like ancient dispensation, because Mormonism believes in dispensations. That's not my worldview anymore, but yeah, they believe that in times past there was prophets that had the absolute truth, and they would have absolutely true rituals, and the temple endowment as the LDS has it now would have been something that Jesus practiced on the Mount of Transfiguration with Peter and James and John and etc.
Right.
So,
and what year were you married? I'm just trying to keep track in my head the timeline a bit.
December 2008.
Okay, so from 2008 up until this conversation in 2012, you said, is that right? You've gone up to Logan to revisit, I guess, again?
Right, yeah, pumpkin walk in 2012 of October. So
what is this? What's going on over these 4 years? You said your shelf had begun before marriage. How does your transition, your discovery, your doubt manifest over those 4 years before this, you know, kind of pivotal moment?
Well, to backtrack, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, 2012 was kind of the transformative year for me. It was earlier in 2012 that I decided to stop paying tithing.
Huh, right.
And the reason for that, I don't know what was all going through my head at the time, but I just realized there was a book that I don't remember who wrote it. It was not somebody of Mormonism that wrote it. It's like, should the church tithe? And when they say church, they mean Christianity as a whole. Should the church teach tithing? And I read that book, and he laid out the case biblically what a tithing was, using every verse that is in the Bible that mentions it and what the practice was. I realized, first of all, that that, and combined with another book, The American Tithe, I can't remember the name of the second book. Anyway, that this 10% gross tithing of your income was not scripturally founded. And so I had kind of put that together. And then at that point, I was just kind of frustrated with everything, how they paid so much money to BYU, how they could build. So the LDS ward is right behind our house. I just remember thinking, I had to pay $4,000 in credit to get my rock wall built, but they didn't have to borrow any money to build their retaining wall. And just everything like that just added up. And I decided to, yes, I'm going to keep giving money to them, but I'm not going to be so stickler on giving them a gross tithe. And so that happened in May of 2012. And so throughout the year of 2012, up to the point of the pumpkin walk, is when I mentioned that I'd couldn't see how the LDS temple could be literally true.
And you said that was surprising for you to say, to hear you say. How did you feel in that moment listening to what you were saying?
Really sad. Yeah, because I put everything into my faith. Up to that point, I haven't read the scriptures a whole ton since my faith transition. Like, not like ritualistically every day trying to get to the point from the first to the end, you know, like trying to read through it. Right. Like, I still read scriptures, but I'm choosing where I'm reading and stuff now. But up to that point, I had read the Book of Mormon more times than most people. So I was just trying to lead with faith, and it was, I could only say sorrow. And I know psychologically I had to work through a lot of this, because people would say, well, it's based on a feeling. If you don't feel good about it, if you're feeling bad about it, or that's the Holy Ghost telling you you're off track, right? But no, I think the sorrow was more based on just realizing the world wasn't what I had constructed it to be. And there's more. It was more complex and more difficult to understand than maybe I had hoped life was to understand.
Right, right. So how does your relationship evolve after this fight? You lock yourselves into the car because you're making the public scene. And then what's the drive like back down? And what's the rest of up from there to now like?
It wasn't good. So 2012 is when I was put on a new shift. I was working, and I'm still currently working that shift. I work four on, four off. And I rotate between days and nights. I work 12-hour shifts. I work at Kennecott as a lab technician. Haven't done anything with my actual degree. But, yeah, so I was just working this weird shift, and when I was on the night shift, I ran into stuff on various sources. The CES letter wasn't even something that existed at the time. So I was just reading stuff from Fair Mormon, Mormon Think, and what I had began deconstructing for me was a literal belief in the Book of Mormon as being a history, a book that reflected the past.
Right.
And yeah, that's what deconstructed next. And then I deconstructed polygamy, and then all the dominoes fell after that. And it just everything. I really got into listening to podcasts after that. So Mormon Stories. It happened pretty quick, and it really scared Brittany. And we had a lot of fights throughout 2013. That was a hard year, really hard year.
And during this time, are you still going on Sundays as a family?
Every week, yes. Yeah, every week. Yeah.
What's that like?
is really difficult because I didn't have a literal belief in sitting in Sunday school and listening to people say things that were patently false. I don't know how. I know people that are still active and go every single week, and I ask them, how do you sit in a classroom where everybody says something that's patently false? And I still don't know how they do it. Some people don't do it. I know some people, and I'm not going to mention by names, sit in the foyer. It's like, really? You're just there for your family? You still go, but you're just going to sit in the foyer the whole time? So I don't understand that perspective. But no, I try to make it work. So I'd go to Sunday school and I'd try to present a more nuanced view. And I would try to mention things, but then like I'd get 10 people after me correcting me. And the one person that corrected me the most is now the bishop. I was like, that's the guy that they're going to call to be the next bishop. And that frustrated me to no end. And I was right that he was the next guy they called to be the bishop, was the most fanatical guy that would correct me after every comment, I would say. So, yeah, I was just really frustrated with it. And one Sunday, just asking myself, my feet walking to church, what are you doing, feet? What are we doing? How long am I going to do this for, you know? I just knew that, as far as like when you're grown up into a tradition where everybody is that tradition, it's really scary to break yourself from it, especially when you know you're not going to have the approval of anybody to break from it. So I didn't break from it when there was no alternative option. So like I know a lot of people do make that scary decision just to go completely inactive and move away from religion entirely, but that was never something I had contemplated, is just becoming a completely religious, that doesn't sound good, completely non-actively engaged with any religion at all.
Right. Now, how about, go ahead, Nancy. Go.
No, I was just going to say, so how do you move from all this difficulty to what helps you to move forward, I guess? Or how do you move forward?
No, so yeah, I listened to, like I said, a ton of podcasts, and I had listened to podcasts that try to put things back together for people in a way that would help them and make sense for them. But then what was frustrating about it, so somebody like Bill Rill, Dan, what's Dan's last name?
Witherspoon.
Yeah, Dan Witherspoon. I would really connect with some of the things that they were saying. And then I got more involved with just other perspectives of progressive Christianity. And I really liked what they were saying. But then I realized what Dan Witherspoon was saying, or what Bill Rill was saying, or whoever was speaking, did not jive with my Sunday experience. So like when I had go back to Sunday, it's like, yeah, I have this new perspective that really helped me. But then I realized what helped me is actually separating me more from the people that are there on the Sunday experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So you need to find some way to have psychological health for yourself while also maintaining increasingly difficult relationships with close intimates. Brittany, certainly, but parents, I would imagine. How does all of that play out?
So, yeah, my dad works for Kennecott, too. That's kind of how I got into my job. He works at the central lab, so not anywhere close to where I work. I work at the concentrator, but I take him samples every time I work on days, and I'd bring up stuff that I would figure out. Like, Dad, there's full-on chapters in 2 Nephi that are Deutero-Isaiah that were written 100 years after Lehi left. And
right.
Every scholar that's credible out there knows that this was written 100 years later. Even computer programs know this was written. It's not written by the same person. How is it possible that this was, how is this possibly true? So when I was deconstructing, I'd bring up things to my dad quite a bit. And I love my dad, but it always came down to poor logic on my dad's part of using a non sequitur. To like, as long as I knew that Joseph Smith was a prophet and the Book of Mormon was true, then I would know the LDS. Yeah, it was all non sequiturs for my dad as far as logic goes. But yeah, I bring up things to my dad quite a bit. as I was transitioning, seeking for help. And I seeked, I don't know, I talked to a few people in my ward, so my elders, quorum president, and I just realized, because people had told me on podcasts, you know, like, as long as you raise your voice, you're going to find the other people. I didn't find the other people.
Right.
Yeah, there weren't any other people that were experiencing what I was experiencing that would vocally ever come up to me and talk to me about it. So so I had a elders quorum president. No, not elders quorum president. I had a home teaching companion that was like, would never skip a month on home teaching. So he'd always reel me into that. And I would find some meaning in that. But anytime I'd give a lesson, it was more nuanced and more a lesson that you could generically give to any religious person, I guess.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, worth of all persons, basically. I would give a lesson of like, hey, look, this dollar bill, there's probably problems with even the analogy, but at the time it worked for me that, like, if you took a dollar bill and crinkled it up, does it lose its value? No, it doesn't lose its value. You could even baptize it and iron it out. The dollar bill's fine. The guy at the gas station's still going to take it, you know?
Right.
Just trying to demonstrate to people that if they're redeemable, like in the sense of a coupon being redeemable, it can't lose its value. Like, you know, it's always worthy in a sense. So like it has worth, you know? So I try to like teach lessons like that and stuff. And so I had heard John Hamer on some podcasts. So I knew of Community of Christ and that scared me and the option of going to a different church. So by the time I had contacted John Hamer, it was like December of 2013. Or January of 2013 was the first time I contacted him, or of 2014, sorry. And I just inbox messaged him. I said, I know you're up in Toronto, but do you know the people that run the Salt Lake congregation? What can you tell me about it? And he started unloading a bunch of information that really scared me because he just like, yeah, Robin's over that area and here's the times they meet. And yeah, so I didn't get up the courage to go to what they had was called a Latter-day Seekers meeting that was apart from the actual congregational experience. And I didn't get the courage to go to that until like April or May. So quite a few months after I actually initially made contact with John. And so by that point, Grant, our youngest boy, had been born. And Brittany wasn't supportive at all of me going to a new congregation. But I went up to a few Seekers classes without her. And I always take a girl. That's kind of how I talked her into it. It's like, well, I'll take one of the kids off of your... so you don't have to watch one of the twins or whatever. So I'd take a twin up with me and go to a few Seekers classes. And by that point, Brittany had deconstructed enough and was frustrated enough at the fact that they excommunicated Kate Kelly and was potentially going to excommunicate John DeLynn that she knew, being a bit more feminist, that there was no hope for people as far as like her position. So I think she was more open to the idea going into that summer. So, yeah.
So you attend by yourself first. How long do you attend solo? Obviously you're taking your daughter, but essentially you're going by yourself. How long does that last? And then when does Brittany join you?
I only went to two Seekers classes by myself.
Okay.
So they only did it once a month. It was like the third Sunday, I think, that they did it on. So I only did that twice. And then we ended up deciding to go to a Community of Christ-sponsored event where Kate Kelly was speaking. And so we went to that. And I already had on the back of my mind that they were going to do this reunion thing. I didn't know much about reunions at all. And so by the time that we went to Kate Kelly thing, I introduced my wife to Robin, and I had talked my wife into going to one night. So reunion's a whole week long, but I talked her into going to one night of reunion up near Ogden. It's up in the Huntsville area.
Right.
So, yeah, we went on one of their camps for a night, and that's where we met Seth Bryant and a lot of other people, yeah.
Could you describe the feeling of your new reunion with faith, or at least a community centered around faith and belief?
Yeah, as far as like finding peace with where I was at, it was just like a big storm. And I had decided going back a little bit. I remember after working one night, just laying on my carpet, and I was just thinking, you know, if I died and everything just went black and I just kind of like slipped out of existence, how wonderful that would be.
Hmm.
And I knew at that point I need some help.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel good about getting therapist type help that was non-Mormon, you know, to like talk through it. I'd always used podcasts to kind of like figure things out. But I did decide to go the route of antidepressants for a while. So I had been taking antidepressants for a while. But yeah, going to reunion was the first time I felt peace with the restoration.
What was the peace you were feeling? What was that about?
Probably validation more than anything. Just somebody to listen to me and just understand what I was talking about. Hmm. And it coming from a leader of an actual church. So knowing that this church had already worked through these things and they were totally fine listening to my story. So I had met Lachlan Mackay. I just did an episode with him. He was a guest minister for this reunion, and he's been overseeing the historic sites for Community of Christ. So he lives in Nauvoo. And I just remember talking to him, and I made... I kind of clicked with him because I already had started a group to try to feel still engaged within Mormonism, because I could feel it slipping away. I started a group on Facebook called Mormon Historians. And so I clicked with him as far as like talking about Mormon history. And so I was just listening to him talk about Book of Abraham. He's like, so wait, what? The LDS Church is finally admitting that the catalyst theory? Okay. And just like listening to him, like processing where the LDS church was at and just talking to him about things and just him being at peace. I don't know, just being up in the mountains and talking to people that were at peace with their faith and already had moved past all these things. Just, I don't know, instantly made me a lot more at peace with it too.
Right. Right. And I wonder if you could comment in as much as you feel you can or are willing. One of the most difficult things people often ask me about transitions when they reach out to me is how you deal with family. And it sounds like you and your dad had a pretty close relationship as you transitioned. How is that maintained, or how has that changed since you've broken with Mormonism?
It's one big elephant in the room to this day. Yeah, it's still not very good. Like the relationship that I have with my parents is pretty good, but it's just not based on religion. So it's just more of our relationship to each other. But yeah, it's an elephant in the room that doesn't come up anymore. So like at one point, I don't know what point of our journey this had happened. They started talking to each other. So my parents started talking to my in-laws, and they were reaching out to us after it was too late. It's like, don't do this yet. And it's like, if you wanted to help us, I've been pleading for that help a long time ago. So by the time that they were reaching out, trying to like tell us not to do anything drastic or anything, I was kind of past that point. But so like when I talk to my dad now, I'll talk to him about Community of Christ stuff a little bit. But yeah, I don't bring up like points to... ask him questions about his own faith, you know, like, right. How do you reconcile this? Or yeah, that just doesn't come up anymore.
Okay, so that's certainly one of the most difficult challenges of this whole thing is the impact it has on relationships that are obviously still important in all of our lives. So I don't want you to have to try and editorialize for everybody out there, but is there anything you would say to somebody who's struggling with this and has, the challenge going on that's current and trying to navigate relationships with extended family or whomever, maybe even it's closer to home, it's a partner and spouse?
I've just been in experience with too many different people to say that it's going to end up this way or that way. So when people say like, oh yeah, it gets better, or I don't know for that person, you know, like luckily both me and Brittany had a faith transition. That doesn't happen for everybody.
Right. Right.
Some parents are really cool with it. That didn't happen for me, you know, or their in-laws are okay with it. My in-laws are not okay with it. So yeah, I can't tell anybody how their faith transition is going to end up or where it's going to lead them or how many people will be supportive or not supportive. But I know that they'll find some people that are supportive of them. There's always some people that they can side with, and whether that's in Community of Christ or Unitarian Universalist or whatever church or organization they can find, there's going to be somebody that they can find if they look for them to go and talk to somebody. So, yeah, no, it's a tough transition, and it's a dark night of the soul for sure. And I don't want to downplay it at all and say it's all hunky dory in the end and people find the gold pot at the end of the rainbow or anything like that.
Because
there's always trade-offs. And I was talking to Brittany about this yesterday, that even within Community of Christ, things that I was lacking in the LDS church, you trade certain things off. Like, I don't think there's a church that meets every human need out there. So like within Community of Christ, I get the more cerebral aspect of it. I get the social justice issues aspects of it. But then the trade-off is I don't have as much certainty as I used to have. And it doesn't meet like my existential needs. Like I'm a bit more afraid of death now than I ever was when I was LDS. Because LDS sit there and testify about how they're all going to live again with their resurrected, perfected bodies of flesh and bone one day, you know? So,
right.
And I don't know that now. And Community of Christ doesn't even project to know that. So, like, the needs that I'm finding in Community of Christ doesn't meet all the needs that I had within the LDS church. But I don't think either of them meet all needs based on whether it's a more conservative religion versus a more progressive approach. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, thank you. Well, Nancy, I can't think of anything else that we should cover unless you have further questions.
No. Nope.
Yeah, so
I'm good.
We always like to end, we say, if there's something you thought we might have gotten to that we didn't, that you wanted to talk about, essentially wanted to give you this chance to have the last word on your story.
On my own story.
Yeah. And whatever comment. I mean, you can just share whatever comment you want to, certainly want to hear about how, you know, maybe where you are at in your, like today, yesterday, where are you at in your spirituality, but any final comments that you want to share?
I would just comment that I don't have all the answers, but I'm a person that tries to live authentically. And I hope things do get better with my family, as far as my extended family with time, as far as religion is concerned. But if anybody's listening to this, just know that I'm a person that'll understand where they're coming from, and I'll be a listening ear with no ulterior motives to have you join the church I currently attend with Community of Christ or otherwise, and that I could be a person that's a safe haven for people that are going through that type of turmoil. And I just know what it's like, and hope that you can find peace within religion. And if you can't, you have my full validation to not be religious. Like, I don't think that's what's most important to, if there's a God out there, that's not what's most important to God. It's just more that you're a responsible adult and that you find peace and wholeness in life. And as far as my own journey, I just hope things get better for, I think within our own individual family, we're doing fine. We're still navigating how do we raise kids in Utah that are not LDS, you know, and how long term we want to actually try to stay in Utah. But yeah, just that we would hope that things could, that elephant won't always remain, but I can't say that it won't because some people still have it decades later. So.
Right. Well, and thank you. And anybody that would like to connect with Josh, you can find Josh at Project Zion, along with Brittany, who's over there. They're both co-hosts. on the podcast that they're sharing with the Community of Christ folks. So we'll certainly link to that in the comments section that we post here today, so you can connect with them over at Project Zion. So thanks, Josh. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this edition of Faith Transitions. Join the conversation on our website, faithtransitions.com, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter.